everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Before we get to my guest this week, I just want to let you know, December 15th to the 18th, I'm performing at the Omaha Funny Bone in Omaha, Nebraska. If you're in the area, come on out. Great club. Always have a blast. December 15th to the 18th. And go to their website, omahafunnybone.com, and you can get tickets there. And if you insert the word Paul, all caps, P-A-U-L, because you're listening to this podcast, you get a big discount on the tickets. So P-A-U-L, promo code Paul, Omaha Funny Bone. My guest this week, Nathan East, world-renowned bass player, has played with such greats as Eric Clapton, Herbie Hancock, Anita Baker, Phil Collins, George Harrison. The list goes on and on. He is the guy when it comes to playing the bass. Everybody has worked with him or wants to work with him, and has a great band in his own right called 4Play. Really cool conversation with him. We cover what it's like to make music. He's got a chilling story that he was supposed to be on the helicopter that Stevie Ray Vaughan ended up being on that sadly crashed and killed Stevie Ray Vaughan. Really great listen all the way around. Enjoy it, and spread the word about the podcast, and go to iTunes and review it, and send the links around to your friends.
We'll start again now.
14 minutes past the hour, 32 degrees in the city.
Let's go to caller number two.
This one goes out to Cindy.
Yeah. We're going to play Guess the Race. The guy talking, is he black or white? I am here with legendary Grammy-nominated bassist Nathan East, who's played with some of the biggest names in the music industry, Barbra Streisand, Barry White, Eric Clapton, Kenny Loggins, Anita Baker. And he has his own album coming out January 20th called Reverence. And it's very, very cool to have you. I have been a fan of yours and have known about you. And somebody in this building, we're at the CBS building, and this woman who runs the talent for CBS, she said, "What are you doing today?" I'm interviewing this guy's a bass player for Eric Clapton. "Oh, Nathan East?"
Oh, no, you're kidding.
Yeah, and I go, "Well, you want to come meet him?" She goes, "Well, I'm not here." Yeah, she's a huge fan.
Aww.
And there's a lot I want to talk to you about. And I don't know a lot about music, which is why I love to talk about musicians, because I'm a comedian, and I think what I do is pretty simple. Like, I hear or think of a word, and I say the word. How you guys put all of this stuff together and hear these sounds and then make this, it's insane to me. But
admiration.
Well, thank you. But I can barely bang a pot with a spoon. But one of seven kids, grew up in Philly, right? At four you moved to San Diego.
Yeah, we're born, and then so four of us out of the seven are born on the East Coast in between Newark and Philly.
Yeah.
And then the rest in San Diego, where my dad took a job at Convair and in aerodynamics and designing aviation, you know.
Oh, cool.
We were always growing up around, you know, drawings of silos and rockets, and
really?
We designed the tail section of the C-5
cool.
and the F-14 swept wings, you know. So
was any of that sort of kind of stuff rub off on you? Obviously, were 14. You were playing the cello, and then your brother was into the bass. You started. It's funny because my son's going through that right now.
Oh,
he
really?
Plays the viola, and he's very good. But he's like, "I'm done with the viola. I want to play." It's not, you know.
Yeah.
He's at that age, so now we got him a couple of guitars, and he's playing that. And
the bass was cooler than the cello. Although I love cello.
Yeah.
To this day, I still love it.
Does the cello? Is there any direct correlation? Does playing the cello help in playing the bass, or is it not?
Absolutely. It's just genuinely with the ear training and just kind of tuning the ear, because the cello is it has you tune it with the pegs, but then it has fine tuners on it as well, so like you really, really, really fine tunes your ear. I noticed for me that was one of the things I benefited from.
Yeah. So when you started playing the bass, was the idea were you influenced by your dad in terms of like, well, he's obviously a scientist or mathematician or whatever, or were you sort of did you already see yourself sort of moving toward the arts?
Well, you know, another thing, I tagged along. My brother David got his pilot's license, and I tagged along and got mine, and
then
four of us have our pilot's license in the family.
And you're a magician.
And a magician.
Do you ever do magic tricks while you're flying? That's probably not loud, right?
No. Actually, no, we do. There's a thing you can do where you you pull the nose back, and then when you push it over, you become weightless. So if you have something like a
really?
Camera or something, you can make it float.
You've done that?
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic.
I'm not flying with you.
Okay.
Crazy bastard.
And then flying upside down is kind of fun.
Oh,
too.
You've done that?
Inverted.
Like the Tom Cruise thing where he gives the guy the
Absolutely.
Finger?
Absolutely.
Wow. So you must be really, really accomplished as a pilot.
Oh, no. I mean, those are things you learn, just aerodynamics of the airplane.
Yeah. And then did you ever do it and go, oh, man, this isn't working out?
You're right. No, it's pucker factor is pretty high.
That's hilarious.
When you do it. But.
I work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and
my favorite,
John Batiste, is in Stay Human, and is all the musicians are phenomenal. And yesterday, Louis Cato, I don't know if you know him, but he's a brilliant, brilliant musician, and he plays bass among other things. And they were just, you know, they play before Stephen comes out, and then Stephen comes out, does a quick hello, and then we do the show.
Right.
And in that moment of playing, he did this like completely improvised bass solo of on the bass of the national anthem, and the entire studio, including the crew, who can be very jaded, were completely mesmerized. And I don't know if they recorded it. They usually don't. If they did, I'll send it to you. But
I'd love to hear that.
What is the function for a neophyte? I feel like the bass is like the critical backbone of anything, but we don't see it or hear it very much. I mean,
you feel it.
Right. And so and I know there's an important relationship between the drummer and the bass player, but explain to me and people who listen who don't know a lot about music but love to hear it.
Right.
What is that function? What is that relationship? What is important about the bass within a group?
Well, you know, the short version is the bass is one of those instruments that if it's not there, you can definitely tell. You know, there's like a foundation, the concrete that you build your house on.
Yeah.
You know, that, and I call that the rhythm section, the bass and the drummer.
Right.
If that's not there, there's just an empty kind of space there. So, and that's our first responsibility, is to be, you know, the foundation for the building. But then beyond that, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are familiar with Jaco Pastorius, who's one of the bass players who he ripped the frets off his bass, and then he started playing fretless and it sounded like, you know, a Fender Rhodes or an orchestra. You know, he had these harmonics, and next thing you know, like, what is that? You know, and I'm sure he overdubbed, but no, it was all taking place in real time.
Really?
And so you have the step out mentality like Jaco, but then you have the...
Explain what step out means.
Step out means the bass becomes a solo lead.
Okay.
Instrument,
yeah,
and or you have the supportive role, James Jamerson, Motown, Chuck Rainey, you know, Ron Carter, all the guys that you know, did tons and tons of sessions, just being the foundation for the song.
Mm-hmm. And like in James Brown's case, I mean,
my goodness.
So who is that person there in that moment? It's James, obviously, but he's not doing it alone. And
exactly.
Is his bass player sort of considered sort of someone that broke new ground or took what was there and sort of built on it?
Well, his band in general was, they were known for how tight they were, you know, and there were all these stories that if you made a mistake, you got fined. And so,
by tight means, like, you hit your note, timing, everything's perfect.
Yeah,
and
tight.
Repeat it over and over.
Over and over.
A comedian who knows, like, every beat of his...
Exactly.
Can say it in his sleep. Jay Leno used to say, like, he would do his act and literally would be going into a trance, like, where he semi-falls asleep or, like, would be thinking about something else. But he was so rote, even with the inflection, that it would sound like he was in the moment. And now I'm not a big believer in being that disconnected from the material, but I would imagine it's the same thing. It's the preciseness of, because if I screw up one little syllable in a setup to my joke, the joke will not fly.
And the timing has to be
so
perfect. People don't realize that that beat is almost like music, you know, where the space between the notes is as important.
Yeah.
And I mean, Dangerfield was my guy.
Yeah, oh God, he was so precise.
He's the best.
I got down a wormhole the other day, and I ended up seeing some of him when he was used to go on the Tonight Show, and it was like just watching.
He'd do 10 minutes standing up, and then he'd sit down, and Johnny would just feed.
Yeah.
And it was the best ever. Yeah.
Did you feel like when you started playing the bass, what was it about the bass as opposed to the guitar or some other instruments that spoke to you?
Well, to be honest, the guitar, my fingers, I couldn't make these chords. With the strings were so close together, and my brother David played guitar, and you know, so I'm tagging along, but just trying to make those shapes for whatever reason, it was more difficult to me. Mm-hmm. So literally just because the bass seemed easier.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of my
choice.
You
have your own great group, sold a lot of albums, Foreplay, and you're going to be on the road again.
Look, right.
When you are writing or you're writing with somebody, is there I know there's exceptions to rules, but generally, like, it starts with some beats. Where does the bass come into that process? The lyrics come in later, maybe the lyrics come in first. Like, how, generally, in your experience, whether it's working with your own band or Phil Collins, and there's a great Phil Collins story I want to talk to you about, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Eric Clapton, like, how do the different sections of a song usually come together?
Which is a great question. I mean, for me, it's not, I don't sit down and go to the piano or the bass and say, I'm writing a song right now.
Yeah.
But my iPhone has a bunch of ideas that came to me, whether I was asleep, half asleep, mm-hmm. or on, you know, driving.
So now I have the same thing. I put it in my notes, but I put
right.
joke, and then I write the thing, right?
Right.
So, like, I saw a homeless guy on a cell phone. Now,
right.
I'm not making fun of homeless people, but in the context of where we're living now, with Trump now being president, and feels like everybody's lying to us, I'm like, how do homeless people have cell phones?
Right.
That's a lie to me. That means you're not really homeless, right? Now, I don't know if there's a joke there, but I write that down, and it's, are you writing down... You're not writing down lyrics. Are you writing down melodies? Are you writing down beats? Like, what are you writing down?
There's melodies, lyrics, beats, and
how do you write? So you go like, you'll write like, da-da-da-da-da-da?
I can either, there are a few ways. I can either, you know, draw it on staff paper or just make up, you know, draw the lines and write notes, you know, notate it that way. Or sing an idea into the iPhone.
Oh.
You know, so sing it.
Oh. Boy, it's like what we do. I just talk the joke in. I have no rhythm or anything.
Well, no, I mean, neither do I. But speaking of that, many, many years ago, I was in Milan, and you know how the homeless guys, you know, they come up and then they'll have a squeegee and start, you know, they'll clean your windshield while you're at the light.
Yeah,
well, the guy was doing that to us. He was one hand, he was squeegeeing the window, and the other hand, he was talking on his cell phone.
You're like, dude.
And this was like 15 years ago, you know.
And he's talking to a stockbroker.
Exactly.
Now, let's put me into some mutual funds. Hey, man, you got a buck? Like,
right.
I literally saw this guy. I'm like, you can't. And it was like an iPhone 7 or 6.
No, exactly.
With the, like, nice earbuds. I'm like, I can't give you any money. Yeah, I mean,
no.
I feel sorry for the guy, but... So you hear these sounds, you put them in, and then so the process, it can come from eight different directions.
A
particular artist or you.
You can never plan when God is going to send an idea to you.
Yeah,
so it's one of those deals where, and literally, you know, sometimes I'm sleeping and what I hate is if I'm too asleep or whatever, and I don't put the idea down, and I know it's something I want, and then I can't find it the next day.
Oh, I know. You know what happened? Tom,
hate that.
I don't know if you know, Tom Fontana is a great writer. He created Oz, the series on HBO. He gets up every morning just before dawn, and his most prolific time is when he's still kind of a little bit in that sleep state.
Right.
He's awake. And he said, and it's quiet, and there's something that's
right.
his most fertile time. And for me, like if I have a couple of shows at night, sometimes I'll have to take a nap in the afternoon. And what happens is as I'm falling asleep in the nap, I'm kind of in the back of my mind thinking about my set. And then something will come, I'm like, oh, if I say this, I can connect. And I have to write it down. And if I don't,
right,
because I've tried not to write it down, and then I'm like, shit, I can't get it.
Right. That's the artist way to the book where, you know, you wake up and write for.
Do you like to collaborate, or is it more sort of your own thing and you bring most of it done and then tweak it with the,
you know,
the other musicians?
Either way, I love collaborations just because, you know, you spark an idea in the other person, then they sing something or play something. And the next thing you know, oh, let's go here. You know, so it's always fun because, you know, with music, you're taking, you know, now a blank hard drive or whatever, and then you're trying to create something to fill that up. So you'll come back and put the layer different parts on top. So it's all for me. I love collaborating.
Well, and you're an important collaborator. I mean, you're really a co-writer in a lot of this stuff. Talk a little bit about the story about Phil Collins and Easy Lover. On the last day of the recording of the album, apparently it was lacking something, and you gave a riff and then you guys wrote for like 20 minutes, and I'm fascinated by that.
You know what? That's a fun story. At the end of a 2-week session in London with, you know, tracking all these tunes, I think the last day Philip said, or day before the last, he said, you know, we still need that undeniable single, you know, something that...
Something's going to pop on the radio.
Something's going to pop, and we can take this to the label and they can run with it.
Okay,
you know?
So back up for a second. I hear that phrase a lot. Can you define for me, being the people that make the music, I mean, I may be asking you to define what it is and maybe you can't. Like, how do you know when you have that thing that's going to pop?
You know, if I said I knew how you know, that would not be true.
Yeah.
But you do know when you have something that feels good. You know, when we were recording Get Lucky, Daft Punk.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody was kind of dancing around the studio.
You know what happened with Stephen Colbert and the Colbert Report?
That was fantastic.
That was the
most
amazing. I was there. In fact, Stephen was on the podcast.
Was unbelievable. They didn't show.
No, because initially it was, we'll get back to the Phil Collins. We got a lot to talk about. Call your wife. You're not going home for a couple
exactly.
of hours. They had what they call an embedded sponsorship in the show around this performance of Daft Punk. So like Hyundai like bought, so
wow.
like it was like,
oh my goodness.
The show rarely did that. So it was going to be like, and now for our Hyundai segment, Daft Punk. So first they say,
oh my goodness.
They don't want to be interviewed because they don't speak, right?
Right.
So they're like, okay, the show's like, okay, a little weird. We're doing talking, but all right, you just come and play. Then they're like,
because the robots.
Yeah. Then they get a call from, the show gets a call from the MTV Video Music Awards people saying you can't have them because Daft Punk's going to be, see, Comedy Central's owned by Viacom. Viacom owns MTV, MTV
right.
Networks. We're all sisters networks. And so they're like, well, are you shitting us? We're like, you can't do that to us. We're like sister networks. And we've had them booked and we've got a big sponsorship built around. Like, no, you can't have them. So the MTV people wouldn't let them play on that night, and we had to do something. So instead, they ended up scurrying and getting everybody, including Henry Kissinger, to...
Plan B.
Yeah, right?
Turned out to be Plan
yeah.
A.
Has that happened musically? Because that's happened with us, like writing on The Daily Show. You sit in a room and you're like, we got to come up with a thing about phones. But then tangential to that comes this other thing that's... way better than what has that,
right.
has that happened to you musically?
All the time.
Yeah?
All the time. I was with him, fortunate enough to record with Stevie Wonder for his last record. And, you know, by the way, you know.
Do you know Fred Yonnais?
Yes.
The harmonica?
He's great.
Yeah, I know
he's
Fred
fantastic.
Through Dave Chappelle, and he plays with Stevie.
Yeah,
too.
He's
yeah.
fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Really,
yeah.
really great player. And so, you know, and Stevie, you know, there's no time frame, so at 2 a.m. you know, he'll show up.
Oh really?
Whatever, yeah. And you know, so at 4 we're sitting in there recording, but he goes in to write a when he goes in to sit down at the piano, and sometimes he'll just start writing a song, then there's 5 songs coming. So you know, the moral of the story is always have some kind of recording device.
Is he pretty collaborative with you?
And oh yeah, he's a collaborative, but he's, I mean, I've never seen a fount of ideas just flow through a person. Like,
really?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Do you think some of that's related to the fact he's blind?
And absolutely.
And that
absolutely.
He's just hearing life
there's
in a
no,
different way?
Yeah, there's no, there's nothing that impedes the signal that comes from,
right.
you know,
yeah.
down through him.
But he'll listen to you if you say, look, that doesn't. Can you say, hey, that doesn't feel right?
Or
is it like kind of?
It always feels right, though.
Well, it's funny. You know, I had Paul McCartney on the podcast, and we talked about the Beatles late years and then his transition to Wings, and he said something to me, and I think he was sincere. He's like, I try to be just as collaborative as, and I said, yeah, I could see, like, the drummer going, to the guy that wrote Yesterday or Let It Be or whatever. No, no, you know, maybe we should do that in a G or something. Like, I'm like, you know, like to the extent you can, I guess.
Well, I mean, with Stevie, I mean, you're blown away every bar, you know, because again, you know, he'll go to write a bridge and then next thing you know, there's four more songs.
And
the bridge never happens. You know, but like there's four more songs get written.
So when you're with Phil Collins and you guys are trying to find this undeniable single,
right?
So how did that come up? What happened?
Well, I remember at that point, and I remember literally thinking, you know, well, it should be something up-tempo. And I remember thinking, hey, what would be a good, if you were at the gym and you were doing jumping jacks, and what would be a good tempo, and what would, and then just kind of this boom, do 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 do. I mean, the song took 20 minutes to write.
Really?
And there was a piano, and we kind of just went to the piano and started fooling around with ideas, and literally, you know, we were singing "Choosy Lover" or something like that, and then Phil Collins went home. And, you know, he kind of said, well, how about Easy Lover? And he started singing what he came up with lyrically the next day. And then I'm just thinking, man, Phil sounds great singing this. I know it's a Phil Bailey record, but... And then so, hey, how about a duet, guys?
You know? Nice.
It's just, I mean, everything was just in real time unfolding.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, it doesn't happen every day. And that's lightning striking, you know.
You know, it was funny because you were playing with Kenny Loggins and... Eric Clapton saw you, and he said, East made up one-third of the sound on the stage. And I wanted you to explain to us what does that mean, and how does that happen in terms of...
Well, first of all, I think Eric, by the way, he's a music scholar. I mean, if you ever hang out and go to a record store with him, I mean, he buys everything, you know.
So he's a history
oh, yeah.
person.
I mean, that's why there's so much depth, and, you know, he's deep. He goes down deep in the blues hole, but jazz and everything, you know. So I think when he makes a comment like that, he's also hearing with his eyes, and he's
don't be modest. What does he mean?
Well,
he's dancing around it. For Christ's sake, what am I going to be, your publicist? You're good. You have a very expensive watch on. Let's go. You fly airplanes upside down, for Christ's sake. How many people get to do that? No, I don't like to define artists by who they work with, because I don't feel it's fair to you as an artist. You're brilliant in your own right.
Thank you.
And I'm sensitive to that because I've worked on shows with big stars, and I know what I bring. But
you know what? I am too. And we kind of get it because we're in the trenches.
Exactly. But without you, you ain't getting Easy Lover.
Well, here's
so,
the deal.
So what did he mean by that?
I think when he looked at the performance, he sees the spirit and the energy that a guy like me doesn't even realize. You're dancing and acting crazy because you're doing what you love doing.
Yeah.
And
but he said the sound,
250,000 people,
the sound, a third of the sound. So how do you generate a third of the sound as the bass player in a band?
Well, I mean, you turn up.
Are you turning your dial to 11? Spinal tap?
I mean, but the thing is, it's pretty much the part, because we were doing Footloose, which is, you know, one of those bass lines that I worked on, you know, until it was honed, until I thought, you know, this is it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what he's not only hearing, but he's seeing the energy that's going. So I think that accounts for a percentage.
So when I watch a band and I watch you, like, and I watch John Batiste a lot, and I see you guys improvising within a song, I don't know, pick a song, maybe it's Easy Lover or whatever. So, like, who's is the traditional band leader, the group leader, leading that improvisation, or is that who decides, like, or is it just like they're vibing off of you, and so you as the bass player go with it, or the drummer, and how are you guys conversing with each other and figuring out when you're going to hand it off or someone's going to take
it. It's a dialogue.
Yeah.
Right? And
but I don't see you guys talking. I don't see you guys going over and whispering.
Nonverbal.
Okay. I mean, I watch you a lot because I'm a performer, and I watch you watch each other.
Right.
But I also watch you being entertained. We had Melissa Etheridge on the show, and she sat in with the band. And it was so fascinating to watch her watch the band. And, you know, the band did one song where they kind of all went around and did a solo.
Right.
And I could see she was, like, really impressed and into it.
Wow.
And digging it. And, like, you could see it in her eyes.
Right.
So I was just curious about how that improvisation starts and how it flows and how the communication happens.
Well, the thing, just the word itself, improvise, means you're literally making it up as you go along. You
right.
know? So you're... You're not using any rules, and you're not really communicating anything. It's just, it's like we're talking, and all of a sudden we're on another subject, and you sparked an idea. So, I mean, basically, if musicians are listening to each other, you're reacting to what you hear.
So you're playing a song the way you normally play it, but
right.
then the guitar, the lead guitarist, maybe does a little something different. You're like, ooh, I like that. And then you kind of respond with a little
you
something
respond,
to the bass.
And it's,
and then
it's a drummer, conversation.
And then the drummer jumps in. And so
right.
so every so it's almost like you're trying, because I wonder if you're trying to entertain yourselves a little bit
and
get out of the routine.
Yeah, if you've played a song a lot of times and now you want to stay entertained and stay in the moment and involved. And so that, you know, improvisation is a very interesting thing, because a lot of, say, classical musicians who everything they play is they're looking at it and reading.
Mm.
Then you say, okay, improvise, and it's like, oh, what is that? You know?
Oh, they get out. It's out of their element.
So, and then the opposite of that is people don't read music, but then they always improvise. You know?
Did you ever play or work with Buddy Guy?
Yes.
And what was that like?
I was just talking about, because we did some recording together with Eric. And we also played at his club and sat in with him, and a few occasions, Crossroads Guitar Fest. And Buddy Guy is unbelievable. Unbelievable.
What makes him unbelievable? What's special about him?
You know, it's the passion and the attitude that you hear. You know, those notes.
A little bit of a swagger?
Yes, those notes seem to come from the bottom of your feet, you know, and all through your soul.
Is it from anger? Is it like sort of defiance?
You know, I think it's from not necessarily anger, but it gets cold in Chicago. You gotta play.
You can only drink so much to stay warm.
Right.
Then you lose your house and everything.
You gotta bring it.
Oh,
you know,
that's funny.
And not only that, you know, just we were playing in the studio, and Buddy Guy did a riff, and then I was, oh, that sounds like that riff Eric is doing. Then I realized, oh, wait a second, Eric, we all listen to each other.
Yeah.
And then, you know, imitation's most sincere form of
it's
flattery.
It's so funny, as I was just thinking, like, you know, I'll see a comic, and you have to be careful not to be taking someone's idea or point of view.
Right.
But I can imagine that you guys influence each other. And if you,
of course,
who would you say, if you could say you had an influence or two in the overall, from like a 30,000 foot perspective, like kind of influences your style and your approach.
If you back up and obviously when you're a kid and you're impressionable, you know, take me to my first concert, Earth, Wind and Fire.
Oh,
watching Verdi and White take his shirt
let me
off
tell
and
you
play.
Something. Dad and Barry White. I have been so
right.
fucked up to those songs. I made out with my wife in my mother's Oldsmobile.
A lot of babies. Yeah.
Barry White.
Oh yeah.
That's
Barry White.
What the hell? That is. He is like to this day. There's six of us that went to high school together. My wife and I met in high school. I was a senior, she was a junior, and we've been together ever since.
Fantastic.
And that's all we would play. We'd play Earth, Wind, and Fire. We'd play Gap Band. We'd play.
Oh, wow.
We'd play
all the tunes.
You know,
Tower of Power.
Tower of Power. Our friend Richard DiNobili played drums, and he was really good, so he'd play Tower of Power riffs when he got drunk on pots and
because that was determined whether you could play or not.
Yeah.
If you could do those Dave Garibaldi.
He was a badass.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So
well, those are, you know, the soundtrack to your life. You know, you remember the car you were in.
Oh God. Yeah.
Know? And yeah,
Fantasy, September, Serpentine.
On.
Oh my God.
Exactly.
If I could sing, I'd actually start singing right now, but that would make everybody throw up.
Well, I actually covered. Actually, the album's called Reverence, and I'm paying homage to people that have left us, like Maurice White.
Yeah, tell that, because I wanted to get into that about what you're doing.
Yeah, and so I actually have two Earth, Wind, and Fire songs on the record, Serpentine Fire being one.
Mm-hmm.
And the special thing about that is 25 years ago, I had an idea for a different version of that tune. My brother and I came up with this track, and actually Phil Collins played drums on it, and Eric Clapton played guitar, you know.
Got those hacks to back you up?
Exactly.
You should have asked him for anybody. You should have said, listen, could you guys send me an audition tape and I'll see if I can use you?
Well,
holy shit. I know, no, I read that and I'm like, Jesus, that's going to be.
The thing that makes it really special is you know, Phil hasn't been playing much drums these days, mm-hmm. you know, because he had a surgery and then he couldn't hold the sticks and mm-hmm. had to tape them to his hands,
yeah.
you know, and Phil's one of my favorite drummers to play with,
yeah.
too.
What makes him special as a drummer?
You know what, his placement of the beat is the most unique placement of any drummer I've ever worked with.
I hate to have you do this, but can you give me an example, like actually doing it, what does placement of the beat mean?
Well, in other words, for instance, In the Air Tonight, who would play pop 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 pop? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way he thinks. You know, Easy Lover, those kind of feels pop 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 pop, and they're just laid back enough that it's just completely different than, you know, 9 out of 10 drummers would play it. That they just are timekeepers and keep great time.
So give me an example of that, the sort of the more rote kind of timekeeper. What would that sound?
You know, like? It's just, you know, just straight feels good, but Phil, he kind of like the snare will just be slightly laid back, you know, and everything is sort of independent.
Mm.
And it's unique to Phil Collins.
Yeah.
And anybody, you know, bass players that have had the privilege of playing with him, you know, Leland Sklar and, you know, people like Daryl Sturmer and Genesis and Mike Rutherford, you know that, like, where he puts it is a really,
well,
really
special
place.
Well, that's the thing
place.
That I think is sort of like analogous to comedy, sort of. It feels like that's where you become the artist, right? Like, we all have the fundamentals. You have the fundamentals of
right.
how to play bass and chords
right.
and chord structure and whatever. Excuse me. And how to joke, tell, and write joke, whatever. But
yeah,
if you're a really good comedian, you have to get to a place where you actually have your own point of view and you're saying something that no one else could be saying or doing.
Right.
And I don't know, you can develop a skill set, but I feel like the thing you just described about Phil and what you do is you either have that gift or you don't. It gets uncovered at some point after you've learned how to do the basics of what you do, right?
Right. I mean, everybody kind of starts with the basics, and then, of course, you have your influences that you like. I find it interesting. A lot of our English brothers have listened to Motown
and
they like feel.
Keith Richards talks about just
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so we're kind of hybrids, you know, and then we're kind of listening to those guys and I'm going, oh, I love Paul McCartney. So he's
been feeding off. Yeah, exactly.
You know, so you get this influence that you've influenced the person that now has influenced you, and it's
right.
Kind
but
of,
what it allows you to do is it allows you to see yourself in a different way through someone else's eyes.
Exactly.
Right? So, like,
exactly.
They're hearing a thing that you've been doing or hearing for years, and you're like, they hear it from their perspective on the other side of the pond or whatever, and you're like, oh wow, okay, I didn't know it was possible to hear it like that.
And that's one of the most magical things I think about music, because you can't really put your finger on what is that, you know, that you can tell. A person plays the same exact instrument. I mean, guitar, for instance, Eric can play one note and you know it's Eric, you know.
Yeah.
Then Santana, you can hear, okay, that's Carlos Santana.
That's another one. I have been so high to Carlos.
It's unbelievable. When I started.
Moonflower, that double album.
Oh, man.
I was in my mother's store and she's not, whatever the first big single was off of that, maybe She's Not There. I'm like, I got to go buy this.
Right.
And I was like a hero to my friends because, like, where did you get this?
Right.
And I had,
exactly.
I had the album and I had the cassette tape.
Right.
And that Europa, all of those songs,
man.
On there. Head, Hands, and Feet.
Still to this day.
That drum solo with the thing.
Right.
Oh, my God. That's the
best. And you think, you know, Hendrix, you know, I mean, these guys are all picking up the same instrument with 6 strings.
And they
each, you know, have put their DNA or their... their identity in that thing. Well, it's, I guess it's like, you know, Leno stands up there with his time, and then Dangerfield, Colbert, like,
and then you kind of
John Stewart, you know.
Find your thing, you know. How do you when you're writing a song, how do you hear, okay, you got a germ of an idea. You said you put something on your phone, whatever it is. Then how do you build on that and go, okay, we need a bridge here. We should have a horn section here. Like, how do you start? That's the part where it blows my mind. Like, how do you start to build on that and create that motif?
Well, at that point, once you have that initial kind of germ or idea, the song, you know, starts to write itself, you know.
Right.
Some music, like the bass line for Tears in Heaven, I always say I didn't play it. The line played me, you know, because I knew Eric's son. And so you're just holding the instrument, and it dictates what you play. You know?
Yeah.
So same with a song. You know that there are certain song forms, and at some point, oh, wait a second, we're going to need a bridge, and the bridge is going to have to lift. So we may go to a higher key position.
And lift because you want an emotional lift there?
Yeah, you want to, you know, now you've got this chorus that you're honing, and everything is there, and now you need to go to another place just to get away from that.
And the bridge is just that. It's sort of this little moment that sort of takes you from this chorus to another chorus or to another, just to, once you use that bridge, do you go back to another part in the song again?
Yeah, you use, and that's why they call it, I guess, a bridge. It's the bridge between that section and another, and a lot of times it'll modulate to a new key, you know, usually higher, and it just kind of gives you a lift because you've been listening to the same key over and over, and now, oh, here's another section, and oh, this is kind of, so if you were in a minor key, sometimes the bridge will take you to a major key, you know?
Oh, okay.
And then that'll take you to the chorus out, and then all of a sudden you're still interested, you know, and so there are really no rules except just, you know, something that you feel like connects with you. And half the time, I think if we like what we what we write, somebody else may.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Connect. You got to satisfy yourself. But go back to the album for a minute and what you did with Earth, Wind, and Fire, because didn't you, like, uncover some tapes or something in somebody's basement?
Well, this was it. My engineer, Mugi Kanazio, he mixed the version of Serpentine from 25 years ago. Literally on the tapes, it's 1991.
And it hadn't been mixed.
And it had been mixed, and kind of like it just went into we hit the pause button, you know, because my brother Marcel and I, we had a group called Two Faces of East. We were going to try to get signed, and then, you know, things happen. You get busy, and next thing you know, so it was kind of like, it was always there, and there was going to be something, you know, we loved what we did with the song. But when I went to go record this album, Mugi had, you know, he was looking for another DAT tape in his in his basement, and he was going through everything. And then he discovered the Serpentine Fire. He literally looking for something. He played it.
He's in Patty Austin's basement, right? Is that right?
Patty lives where... Yes, she lives where I used to live.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
And so there were 24 track master tapes down in the basement, you know. But he played this for me one night at the studio, and we just freaked out, you know, because I had forgotten the energy that was kind of in this track that we put together. So we went searching through the basement for it, and then we actually found these 24 2-inch tapes. And you have, you know, if you haven't played them in a quarter of a century, you have to bake the tape, literally put it in an oven.
Otherwise, it might snap or break.
It could break, or the material will start to, you know, deteriorate and come off. So you bake it before you play it. So we did that 12 hours, you know, 400 degrees or whatever it was. And I can remember we pulled it out of the oven, and they put it on a 2-inch machine, which, you know, those are rare to even have in the studio. We hit play, and everybody was freaking out.
Wow. And so
really
you've
cool.
got Eric, you've got Phil.
Right.
And do you have any of the guys from Earth, Wind, and Fire jumping? Is it Maurice?
And then we called. Chris Giroux had a great idea. So he said, well, why not have Earth, Wind? You know, so we called Philip Bailey and Verdine White, one of my mentors on bass, and Ralph Johnson. And then we actually found some samples of Maurice singing that we're, you know, we may or may not use depending on if we can get him cleared or not. because he's not here to ask.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's, I mean, he is literally, you know, he's a fellow Sagittarian. So
there you go.
You know, one of the guys I, you know, revere and influenced me a lot.
Yeah.
In music. So when he passed away, obviously it was it was a piece of my heart.
Oh, yeah. Did you ever work or do anything with Sly and the Family Stone?
You know, I was in the record plant once, and Sly was in the next room, so that's close as I got.
So what
to
happened? He kind of, it felt like, I don't want to say flash the pan, but much, you know, given the level of talent that he had, it felt like he came and went pretty fast.
You know what happens too is you gotta. I'm not sure why. You know, your work ethic, and you know, back in the day, everybody was getting high.
Yeah.
So some people really didn't survive. You know, like you stayed there.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Well. Yeah. I mean, look at Elvis and whatever.
Right.
There's this great thing about Anita Baker and. And I don't know if this is true for you, but your most memorable session with Baker was on the 1990 album Compositions, and it says her mission on that project was to sing everything live with the band and make it a record of performance. East explains, you're not just recording a track, you're performing a song, and that requires a little different mindset. Explain what that mindset is.
Well, you know, in the studio, we're everybody's pro, and they come in, and you're making takes of songs, so you're making a record. But when you're out on stage and you're performing a song, it's completely different energy, and you have an audience, and so with this concept, she wanted it to be like a performance, you know. So it's not really, oh, we're gonna make this slick track where everything's going to be.
We'll do six takes.
We'll
on
do
that
six
part of the
takes,
song.
Right?
We'll do the bridge again.
Exactly.
Blah, blah, blah.
Right. You know,
which can sort of sap you. It's like acting. You know, I think Clint Eastwood has a thing. Like as a director, he never asks for more than three takes because at some point it's a point of diminishing return.
Exactly.
So
happens
anyway,
a lot.
Yeah,
same thing.
Yeah.
So in the studio, you know, and very few singers even really try to approach the music with that because now you have Pro Tools and you can. You know, the producer, oh, that sucked, come on in, you know, they can auto-tune you.
But why wouldn't you want to do that all the time? Because it seems like, A, it's more fun, B, it's more time efficient, it gets you out of this, right? And there's an energy. I understand you don't have an audience there to give you energy, but I guess it's just safer to kind of able to do take.
Well, I think it's more of an old-school way of recording. Like Marvin Gaye and the Smokey Robinsons and all of the world, you know, they went and sang. You know, you just didn't have this auto tune, or you can go back and punch.
Yeah.
And they sang from top to bottom.
Yeah.
You know,
but I would think that's more appealing to performers.
I would think so as well.
So this was because this sounds like it was sort of an aberration or an exception rather than the rule that she wanted to approach the album.
Absolutely, because I think recently now with all this technology that allows you to go in and redo it and okay, tune that up, and you know, everybody's kind of forgotten that, oh wait, there's some singers that they don't need all day to try to do the first verse.
So what is that mindset exactly? Said, God,
trust
I got the
me,
verse.
I've been
we
there.
Got the first verse.
Take
so you
weeks.
Guys,
yeah.
Oh my God. So what is the mindset that you need to be able to pull that off effectively?
Well, this mindset, and a lot of us that were in the room, you know, have performed together. Steve Ferroni on drums, Greg Fillinganes on keyboard. You know, we're used to being in front of an audience, and so. One of the things I like to do, it's a little exercise that when I'm in the studio, I like to pretend that I'm playing live, you know. So I bring that kind of energy. And
so
then
you have like women throw panties at you? I know how that is. I do that too. Yeah.
Woo! You do that all the time.
Guys run up and give you cocaine.
Right. Exactly. So, and then when I'm playing live, I like to pretend I'm in the studio. So it tightens me up.
Yeah.
So there are no panties.
Yeah, exactly. No,
but, you know, it does. You know, it's all about, you know, the way you approach it. Everything's in the approach. Same as when you're flying. Your approach to landing determines whether
it's probably
a
little bit more
good
on your toes. You're a little less.
Yeah.
You're a little bit more front of your head.
And the other thing is you have to, you know, if you're going to play a song from top to bottom, you know, you have to kind of, it's a challenge for everybody. It's six people to do
really?
Top to bottom.
Why?
It's
you do
just
it all the time. But, yeah, stop but, whining. You're not digging ditches in the heat.
No, exactly.
No, well, no, no. I'm kidding.
We'll never have.
No,
that
no, no.
Problem.
But why is well, that? Would seem to me like you guys would do that all the time on the road.
Well, I'm
right?
I'm just thinking about in terms of getting all the notes right and the arrangement and everything and the magical performance.
Yeah,
you got to get that one magical performance that everybody in the room says that was the one.
Yeah,
you know, and you're all listening. And there's a song called Fairy Tales on that record that it goes on for about 11 minutes. And we're just having so much fun, we didn't want to stop.
Oh, wow.
And you could hear Anita Baker laughing, you know, on the fade where everybody is just, I mean, it was one of those, you know.
And that's a big improvisation, right, which we were
exactly.
talking about earlier where sort of everybody's feeding off of
it's like a
else.
Zen moment also, yeah. You know. It's like, hey, we're here and this everything is clicking. It's yeah. kind of like a watch, you know, everything's yeah. work, and so we're here, and nobody wants to let it go.
Yeah, it's a special moment to get into that place.
Oh, it's fantastic.
That happens can happen with an audience. There's every yeah. once in a while you yeah. get into a place where it's like, it's just every single thing.
You can't go wrong.
You cannot go wrong.
Yeah.
The only way you can go wrong is to overthink it, is to start getting in your head too much and staying and getting out of the yeah. moment and not letting yourself just sort of. Kind of be. I wanted to mention. I'm a huge Stevie Ray Vaughan fan, and that
oh,
sort
man.
Of that you were on the helicopter and then got off the helicopter, right? To
right.
tell people that.
Well, that was the darkest day of my life, by the way. But just knowing that, you know, we had four helicopters go from Chicago out to Alpine, yeah. which would be normally at least 2 hours in a car, but by helicopter, it was a quick. You know, 20-minute flight or whatever.
And you were playing him, Eric.
Eric, Robert Cray. It was a great
yeah.
night of music.
Yeah.
You know? And right before he got on the helicopter, as a matter of fact, I mean, we all jammed together. We did, I think, Sweet Home Chicago. You know, so, you know, the last song he played together, we all, you know, made music. And again, I say, you know, little do you know.
Yeah.
When your last statement's going to be.
Yeah.
And we had four helicopters, and so I had ridden up and back on that one and up on the same one. But one of my friends, who's a pilot, and I'm a pilot, he offered me a ride back in the twin Cessna. So, of course, let's fly. And usually it's a guy that peels away from the pack, and then you hear details 11,
right.
you know.
Exactly, that's the guy, yeah.
But this was the opposite. I diverted from the group, and they had a car waiting for me. And I asked Greg Fillinganes, you want to go on the plane or the helicopter? He said, okay, I'll go with you. Mm-hmm. So two of us that came on that one helicopter left and went to the airport to fly, you know. And then we found out the next morning that, you know, there was a little ski slope, 200-foot-high ski slope behind the gig that and the helicopter pilots were giving people rides during the day. But at night, it was completely in a little fog, maybe 1 a.m., and the four helicopters left, and one never made it back, you know, and it went into the...
It hit the only hill. It hit that little hill?
That little slope, yeah.
I always thought it was wires, that it hit wires.
No. That was...
And that was the helicopter you were on.
That was the one I was on.
He literally took your seat.
Literally.
Wow.
Yeah. No, it was so to find out about that, I mean, it was just you know, tragedy. We'll never get over that one.
What made him special as a musician, as a guitarist?
You know, the same thing where your notes are unique to your DNA and your life and.
But what did he bring that Eric wasn't bringing, or Buddy Guy didn't bring, or Muddy Waters? Like, what was it that he was bringing?
You know,
what was his take on it that made it uniquely Stevie Ray?
I think different areas of the country produced a different flavor. You know, I was recently in Nashville, and the Texas swing. You know, that some of the bands, you know, they do it just a little bit different in Texas than they do in
Chicago.
In Chicago.
Maybe it's got a little bit more of a country
exactly.
sort of undertone.
You know, Nashville, they do a little bit of different of a twang, you know.
Yeah.
There's a group called the Time Jumpers that play every Monday night at the Third and Lindsley in Nashville. These guys are unbelievable.
Time jumpers?
Time jumpers. Yeah, you got it, and they have a few
I'm writing it down.
Out. Yeah. Vince Gill plays guitar in the
oh,
band.
Wow.
And it is like music of the highest order, you know, and I think they call it Texas Swing. I mean, those guys have a pocket and a swing that I've never heard before. It's
really?
Really beautiful.
So it's sort of this sort of mashup of sort of influences. And so with Stevie, I could see that Texas thing maybe
yeah,
a little bit. And then,
you know, there's even, you could hear a little jazz in there too. I mean, there's some sophistication
yeah.
in there that is just amazing. And Stevie, he was just in a league of his own, you know, just by himself, just... There aren't too many people, but that's what I'm so impressed. Guitar, Jeff Beck, he picks it up, and it's only he can make that guitar sing like that,
right,
you know. And
right.
That's amazing,
right? Like you said, like Carlos, you know Carlos, he likes those long notes, and
right.
And they don't write those 9 minute, 10 minute songs anymore.
No,
I was thinking about that the other day. Like you can't because of the business now. Nobody writes 10 minute.
You can't. Know, like, but it's funny, Pat Metheny. One of his last albums, probably in the last 10 years or so, it was a 74-minute song or something like that, like start to finish.
Oh, he started. Wow. That's insane. You know Will Lee, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know Will because when he was at the Letterman show, the band there, I'd been
right,
on the
Will's
show.
Will's he's right down the street.
He's
he lives,
a super talented
oh,
guy.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Super nice guy.
Yeah, I love him.
Listen, everyone, on January 20th, which is actually Inauguration Day, so
right.
If you want to,
so you're gonna have a little reverence on
yeah,
that
I was
day.
Say, there you go. You picked a good day, man.
Come on,
people are gonna be running from their TVs
Who
and want
knew?
Something to do. You go buy an album. Don't go on Amazon. Go to a record store if they still exist.
Exactly.
And,
no.
You know who did a really? You should watch Colin Hanks, Tom Hanks' kid, did a documentary about Tower Records. And
I
history.
Just heard about that
you
yesterday.
You should see it. You would like it and appreciate it.
Yeah,
from
I had
the
no
heart,
idea.
Really, really well done.
Well, in Japan, there's 100 Tower record stores.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's the biggest CD market, I think, in the world.
They're still doing CDs and, over there, huh?
And, you know, I go there and kiss the ground because there's 8 floors of records and CDs, and, you know, that's part of our, you know, pastime growing
up. Yeah, absolutely, man. You got to have that. Yeah, it's nice to have something to hold on to touch.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, again, you know, I hope we don't lose that in music, you know, just listening through these little devices that Steve Jobs so brilliantly came up with. But you know, the first thing that you lose is the bass response with these little buds.
Oh, you know? Yeah, that's
so
right.
Like, you know, we go in the studio and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars recording this record with, you know, three microphones on the amp and going direct and all the best engineers, and then you then you get pumped through a $24
some kids listening on a speaker the size of a dime on a subway with all this noise
exactly
around, right?
No, it's so you know as opposed to what we used to do, we'd crack that record open and put it on and you'd just listen.
My mother's Oldsmobile, the back windshield was like a 45-degree angle. We put like a subwoofer. We put this killer.
Fantastic.
All my four of my friends, we got all of our money, and we picked my mother's car because it was really fast. It had a 350 V8 4-barrel, and we would just blast with it. And the sound would bounce. It was like perfect, acoustically perfect.
Wow.
Then my mother hit
your studio.
Yeah, but then my mother backed into a school bus because she doesn't bother to turn around and look. Like, so who backs into a big yellow bus that doesn't see it, right? She's like, oh, I got to go. And she just literally, like, doesn't turn her head. And she rips a hole in the right rear quarter. But it made it like a portal bass. It actually improved the sound in some weird way.
Oh, man.
And we would just sit in that car. We got...
Wow.
One time, real quick, it was a bad, bad snowstorm. We're on this. And it's like, hey, it's snowing out. Let's go out. Like, instead of, like, we'd go out in the car and we'd smoke, right? And then we had Pink Floyd on.
Oh my goodness.
And it was cranked and we were just there.
And you were lit.
And then we're driving up this highway and it's like white. You can't see the hand in front of you. And then all of a sudden we see yellow lights in the sky blinking, going across from left to right. We're like, whoa, it's a UFO, whoa. It was an overpass. It was a snowplow going over an overpass, and we thought it was aliens. But I'll never, like, that's what music does for you.
Oh, no.
I always say, I'm trying to write a bit about this, people don't love songs from their past because of the song so much, but because of what the song represents to them in that moment in time. I mean, not to take anything away from the song, but the song has to be great. But there's always a for special songs, I think there's that connection to a.
You remember where you were, who you were with.
My girlfriend.
Exactly.
I was in a car stone thinking I was seeing aliens or whatever, right?
Right.
So anyway,
we've all had the same experience.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, but that's what. And the albums always sound better, right? The
albums sound amazing, yeah.
So, it'd be too bad. It's too bad we can't go back to that. Forever,
well,
but I mean,
you know, at some point, we still have to. Again, we have to revere where we came from.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And I still love albums too, you know, because there's this big, wide kind of lots of air.
Yeah, know? Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, January 20th. Don't watch the inauguration; it'll probably just depress you. You go by yourself. This fine CD by this up-and-coming musician. He's going to be a big rage. No, really, just I could talk to you all day.
Oh, no, this is too much fun. We'll have to book
another
session.
Yeah, if I come to L.A., I go there. We'll do another one.
Yeah, come on.
Because I got a whole bunch of
You can come to my studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's cut a record where I sing really badly and embarrass my son. My son won't let me sing in the house.
You know that's bad when he won't let you sing in the shower.
Oh, my God. And he's like, he's so funny now. He's like really attentive. He's got a couple of zits. He's constantly working on his face. I'm like, what are you, a movie star from the 20s? I got to do this. Dad, he started to shave a little bit. He goes, I got a little bump over here on my neck. I go, yeah, it's a little from shaving. He goes, what do? I go, you just keep shaving and then it'll go. It's like,
get over it.
What are you like? He goes, can we get some other shaving cream? I'm like, no, we're not getting other shaving cream. This is Aveeno shaving cream. It's fine. Just, this is what happens. Your body will get used to it. All right. Like, he's just.
Oh, that's funny.
I was on the road. You know, when you're on the road for a while and you call home? I call home. Hello.
Wow.
And I'm like, is my wife banging another guy? My son's voice changed.
Overnight.
Yeah. Another time I came home and his face got wider, like his eyes moved. Like I
Man,
was
how
going,
long
like,
were you gone?
Well, I was gone a couple of years. I don't really care for my wife. And no. we're juicing him a lot so that he grows fast. Nathan East, Reverence, January 20th, 2017. Go get the CD, Foreplay. You got tour dates coming up?
We got some dates coming up. Yeah, we're going to the Carolinas this weekend. It's on our website, foreplayjazz.com.
All right.
We'll give you all the dates.
I want to come see you play.
Come on down.
We'll exchange info.
Absolutely.
And you should come to a taping of a show if you want to come see a taping.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. I record it every night.
And I'll have you come early, and you can hang and say hi to John.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Love those guys. They're a great band.
Oh, God, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was, it's just, he's so funny, too, when you talk to him, because he's present, but not, hey, man! Like a lot of that. It's such a, hey, yeah!
Right?
Yeah, really, really.
No, there's a great energy. And that was a big shoe to fill, you know, I mean, after all those years.
Yeah,
everybody was wondering, who could do this? How? You know.
Yeah, it's and I think the show's, you know, it's just great, and that theater's unbelievable. So anyway, great to have you. We'll do
great
this
to
again.
Be here.
Thank you so much.
And thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah, go get yourself a CD now. All right, and then you just hunker down, and then 4 years it'll all be over, and we can come out feeling like human beings again. Thank you, buddy.
Thanks a lot. See you soon.
All right, that was Nathan East. Could have talked to him all day. In fact, I'm going to do another interview with him. Really cool insight into how music is made and what it was like to work with all of these greats in music. December 15th to the 18th, Omaha Funny Bone. Come on, check me out. And you can go to omahafunnybone.com for tickets and use the promo code Paul, all caps, and you get a little discount there because you're listening to this podcast. All right, thanks for checking it out. Talk to you next week, and please send this around to your friends and go review the podcast on iTunes. Thanks, everybody.